A brief thought experiment. You could close your eyes, you could leave them open, but imagine one or all of these scenarios. You are applying for a mortgage, or you are awaiting a promotion, or you are pulled over by a police person with a very small amount of marijuana in your car. In any of these three scenarios, would you choose, if you could, to be male or female? White or black? Young or old? Almost exclusively, were it a choice behind the veil of ignorance, as John Rawls described it, we would all choose to be young or middle-aged white men, preferably taller. That's the standard of who gets promotions, who doesn't get cited or charged, who gets good mortgages. I want to talk about one of those in particular, one of those that is very much a burning issue in our news among artists and producers, politicians and business persons, gender. The question of women's rights and the gross differential between women's attainments, security, safety, job prospects, and men's. We'd like to imagine that this is a new issue. When autism diagnoses sparked in the 80s and 90s, and people were wont, wholly mistakenly, to attribute that to the rise in vaccines, that was a correlation without causality. That was most likely due to better reporting. And I think the spate of accusations of sexual assault, sexual misconduct, harassment since the tapes arrived of our now president about a year and a half ago is much more about reporting than anything else. We have that sensibility in our Torah too, this imagination of an idyllic prior age. There is, by some accounts, our sages love to create numbers and place numbers and ages and names to things. That's one of the great impulses of Midrash. They like to understand that Isaac was 37 by some accounts when he was bound by his father, not the young man, the young child we imagine him to be. And until he was married, they say at age 40, he was in the Garden of Eden, which I haven't investigated further how they thought we could return there because it was sealed to us by the flaming cherubs' swords. Nonetheless, we might imagine that prior to the age of madmen, or even in the age of madmen and in the 70s, these things were not problems. That's not true. And we might like to imagine that these accusations against people like Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, Al Franken, are of malign intent. Wish Bernie Bernstein was here. There's actually a smear campaign going on in Alabama. People are getting robocalls from a person, a Washington Post reporter called Bernie Bernstein, because Jewy McJewerson was not available, and asking people if they want to report an assault by Roy Moore and would receive $5,000 to $10,000 for making such an accusation, whether or not it's verified, which is to convince people that it's just a scheme of the media. So we'd like to imagine that these things are not new, and it would be so much easier if all these accusations were false. But as Seth Meyers points out with Bill Cosby, you know, if it were only a case of he said, she said, so on and so forth, you know. You might only like to believe the first dozen rape accusations and not all 60 against Bill Cosby. So there are these series of wells that are dug in the parsha. I think it was in the part that Mary Ann read. And one of the wells, actually, was just before that, gets of disputed provenance. Who should own it? Isaac or the others, the local peoples? And Isaac and they name it Sitna. the place of animosity, the place of dispute, which comes to teach us, say our sages, that there is not a righteous man who does not have detractors. True that. True that. I mean, there are inevitably false accusations of any crime. People sign on for and settle for a lot of guilty verdicts that would be unwise. I think some vast majority of criminal cases end in settlement, and the implication is that not all of them could possibly be guilty, but sometimes it's easier than fighting the case. Yes, that's a fact. I remember working at a camp once, and the kids were joking each other that such and such counselor raped them. That was just a joke they were making, and I was like, you cannot ever make that joke. It's a very dangerous thing to say. On the other hand, with that caveat, and I'm not judging one person or another in the news, we don't know yet, I think that's fair to say, except for persons like Al Franken and Louis C.K. who have quickly and courageously admitted to their wrongdoing and become accountable and sought redress. We don't know the full facts. There seems to be a preponderance of evidence in certain cases, but we don't know, and I do believe in due process in the court of law, if not at least also in the court of opinion. But these things are not new. Even in our parasha, we have these awful, or at least strange and awkward examples of our ancestors doing things that clearly represented a mistreatment of women. Isaac presents his wife Rebecca as his sister as he travels through the land out of fear that he would be murdered and killed so that she might be acquired and raped or assaulted or misused. And then the local king views Isaac having relations with his wife, which implies another sort of inappropriate boundary of doing things publicly where others might see. Jacob is not really a swell guy, neither. We hear him doing things b'mirma, in secret, beyond the view of the public, couched in subterfuge. Jacob is described by Esav, again, in Torah itself, Esav not such a bad guy, in a rabbinic imagination, a terrible guy, but that regardless, it doesn't excuse Jacob being Yaakveni, living up to his name of being the grabber, being the heel grabber, being the groper, the catcher. Our sages, we know our ancestors, we know this from experience that our ancestors are not perfect. That's, as Josh Gettinger would point out, one of the great advantages or advances and innovations of Torah, that our heroes are not two-dimensional. Our heroes are not like Achilles. They're not supremely courageous and constantly strong. They are weak and flawed. So let's accept that. That's not the same excuse as saying, well, that was 40 years ago and things were different then. Just because they were culturally norms doesn't mean they were ethically permissible. There's a difference. And, even to the extent of adults marrying or having relationships with people who are inappropriately young, we have that. It's not known in Torah how old Isaac and Rebekah were, but we're told in Midrash that Isaac engaged her when she was 3, married her when she was 13, and waited to conceive until she was 23. Unsavory. Even if it was once culturally norm, and we see that in the Mishnah, it shouldn't make us wholly comfortable with it. That they lived in an era of even less women's rights than we have now, of even less women's economic power than we see now, didn't excuse the mistreatment of half the population. We have to swallow, we have to digest, and not whitewash our ancestors' behavior, not whitewash the mores of Torah and Mishnah and Talmud and the medieval period. They were an element of their context, but that's only interesting in as much as it allows us to void the law itself by saying that was a taboo then, that was a structure then, that doesn't have to apply to us now. We can rethink things in light of what we know about the biological equity between women and men, races, among peoples, the value of the aged. That's actually one of the most persistent prejudices I was reading is ageism, which I don't look forward to because certainly with rabbis you see it, which is the most strange, because you certainly the prerequisite or the necessity for a rabbi is wisdom, which is only acquired through age and effort. That aside. And then we see other issues of boundary violations, of ignoring and ignorance of the value of treating another person as an ends and not a means, as Kant would push us to do so. The sensibility that women existed merely for men's status and attainment. Rashi notes that when Sarah became pregnant, there were those who said that it was Avimelech's conception, that Abraham had not been able to conceive with her, that there'd been a delay. The reason was that Abraham was not fertile or not able to conceive, and that she conceived through Avimelech, the local king. So Rashi says, well, they made sure that Isaac looked a lot like Abraham. God made sure that Isaac looked very much like Abraham to remove doubt. Again, we shouldn't be comfortable with our ancestors' actions, nor should we, for a moment, be comfortable with neither the possibility nor the likelihood that many men in power, visibly, noticeably, publicly, are now being explicitly exposed for their misdeeds. Nor should we forgive ourselves for the everyday part we play in fostering and benefiting from a culture of misogyny and hierarchy and inequity. We live among it. Men are much more likely to get promotions, especially in the tech sector, which is a growing part of our economy. We still use words and perceive things in certain ways that belie great prejudices. We should not pretend that they are done. We work on them. You know, the great thing about America, for all its flaws, and I would say this too of Israel, and I have said this, don't pretend these societies are okay and perfect, but understand that unlike perhaps Russia or Zimbabwe, we have redress. We have the rule of law, we have social structures and openness, we have not to use liberal versus conservative politically, but the liberal structures of an open society to talk about problems. Thank God. It's okay to have problems as long as you can be accountable and aware and work on them. On the human level, on the microcosm of a person, as well as on the societal level. And that's, I think, as I've said before, always inherent in our tradition. That whatever our tradition is telling us, when we look at Torah and tradition and Mesorah, the wealth of our culture and heritage, and we see, oh, that's really ugly, that makes me uncomfortable. As I said before, the arc of history is long. I didn't say this, Martin Luther King said it, but it bends towards justice. What I said is that our tradition's effort is to bend the arc toward justice. It's not enough, but it's a good start. And so, you know, I've joked with people, I don't know if it's a great joke and I'm embarrassed by it, but I'll say it. And all these horrible things that we hear about Harvey Weinstein, for example, I feel less bad about the way I treated people in my 20s. Not that I ever did anything that extreme, but I was not a decent person in a lot of ways. I did not serve women that I dated or was friends with the enough kindness and equity and consideration, and really viewing them as whole partners in the work of life and creation. I was part of it too, and I'm still part of it. We've never had a woman rabbi. I'm not saying we should, I'm very happy to be here, but I'm just saying, you know, we haven't, I benefited from that. I benefited from race and gender many times. You know, and politicians are saying things like, well, I have a daughter, so I'm concerned about this. That's a strange attitude. You should be concerned about it as a human, and I want to get to a slightly different place. So I've spent a lot of this week in dread and anxiety, thinking about my own misdeeds, thinking about the deterioration of civil society, thinking about the sadness that I have for the relations among genders and sexes, but also among peoples of various degrees in life, old and young, white and black and Latino, different countries, different city versus country. But there's a little piece of me that's grown optimistic, and I want to share that with you. there's a piece of me that thinks this could all be for the good, not for Bill Cosby. So in reference to this week's parsha, some of our sages talk about this. They ask the question, with all the pregnancies and births of this week's parsha, the one I pointed out to you earlier, Esav and Jacob coming out of Rebekah, they think about the birth of human beings, and they talk about the evil tempter, the wicked impulse, Yetzer Hara. And they ask, so when does the wicked impulse gestate? At what point is it part of our creation? And they debate whether it starts with the embryo or it starts with the birth itself. But what they do say is that the Holy Blessed One says to us, I created the wicked desire, I created the evil impulse, and I also created Torah as its antidote. If you wish, you can master the wicked impulse. Now that's a teaching that spreads far and wide. The central Jewish idea that we are not fundamentally flawed, or at least that there is no unforgivable original sin. We are fundamentally flawed, but we also fundamentally have a superego, so to speak, the good impulse that can master our wicked impulse. That the things we do that are wrong at any age in any person can be remedied slowly, bit by bit, with hard work, with great labor, not just through Torah, although that's a source of one ethical impulse, but through a lot of places. Our tradition understands that. I'm thinking about that statement by some politicians. Well, I have girls, I have daughters and a wife and a mother, so I'm concerned about women's rights. It's not the origin of women's rights that you have a sister. That might create empathy, but there is a deeper understanding, would say John Locke, would say, I believe Rousseau, of where rights originate. There's something important and essential about them that has nothing to do with who you know. So here's what I'm thinking about, why I'm optimistic. So Rebecca in this week's parasha says, one of my other favorite things, the first was the verse I taught you, 25:22 this morning. The other is when Jacob conceives to steal with Rebekah the birthright and goes in to fool Isaac in his decline. Jacob's terrified, you know, this is going to lead to a curse on me and my whole generations. And Rebekah says, your curse, I'll carry your curse. Alai kilaltecha, I think, or kilal. I'll carry your curse. Just an interesting question ethically, you know, the ways in which we bear the burdens of our society, the way in which we support other people, but that's not the place I want to go right now. One of our traditions, the Da'at Zakenim, the wisdom of the elders, says it's something generally accepted that when children do not behave in the manner they should, it is their parents that are blamed for not bringing them up properly. My children weren't so well behaved at the Kalah, so I took some heat for that. But that's not what I'm saying right now. What I want to think about, having four boys, is that it's at least as important that I have a sister, that I have a mother, that would cause me to be concerned about women's rights and women's equality and feminism, as it is that I have four sons. And I don't want to forget to say something Ethel Wittenberg said, which is, a feminist is anyone, let's see if I can recreate it, anyone who knows that a woman can do just as well as a man, roughly. That's not enough, though. It was great, I remember that in her eulogy, but it's not enough. It really requires working to reshape our society. It really requires that my sons not be like my fathers and ancestors, that their understanding of gender rights, of equality,